questions. And I've been telling a few people during the interview time, many of the questions you ask, it's a shame you don't write them on pieces of paper, because they're great questions, and that way you can share them out with everybody. So really encourage, and you've been in interviews, write them on pieces of paper. Okay, here we go. Question number one. What is the difference between awareness of present moment and silent awareness of present moment? Step one is not silent. What are the differences? Okay, the first step is just being in the moment. No past, no future. You know the present moment because of exclusion. It's not the past. It's not the future. So there's only one thing it can be. The present moment. So if you've not got any thoughts, not looking backwards, you're not looking forward, right now, it must be the present moment. So that's how you know what the present moment is. But the silence in the present moment is not giving a commentary to what's happening. An example of that, suppose you are watching sometimes it's Sri Lankan people, I say cricket match. Suppose you're watching a tennis match. Well, no, let's go better than that. You're watching a soccer match, and it is between, there's a lot of people from Malaysia here, from Malaysia and Australia. They're playing the soccer. Now, if you listen to the commentary from Malaysian TV, and you listen to the commentary from Australian TV, it'll be very different. Malaysian TV, Australia's never scored a goal, that was offside. The referee must have been blind. And Australian TV, no, it was not offside, it was a clear goal. Because all commentary is biased. Which is why it's very interesting, instead of listening to the commentary, if you watch the TV, turn the sound off and just watch the match without any sound. You know, I did that once on an aircraft, because it had these screens coming down, and there was a movie on, and I didn't have any headphones. But actually, I watched the movie without any headphones, and it was Armageddon. And it, I don't know if you remember that movie, and I was roaring with laughter. I was kidding myself, because it was the most funny thing. If you take off the sound and the commentary, it's actually stupid. It really is. Because I remember seeing on this screen, they had this spacecraft, and they were going to some asteroid because it was going to hit the Earth. You know it wasn't going to hit the Earth. It was a movie, okay? So they had, and they went to the, and one of the guys there, it was the hero, I forget some big sort of actor, he hit this asteroid, and I think something wrong with the spacecraft must have been. And there was explosions and sparks, and they went down the cliff, and more explosions and more cliff. And, you know, it went up about 2 or 3 minutes, you know, the special effects. And then so many explosions, so many, you know, huge impacts. And then it went silent. And then you saw the hand come up. And then the hero. No one would be able to survive such an impact. You know, just one of those crashes would have killed everybody. But he and his hair was perfect. And not a bead of sweat, no marks on him at all. It was absolutely crazy. And as soon as I saw that, I burst out laughing. And I was just, people thought I was crazy. Because now, when you got the sort of music and the commentary, you feel a great sense of relief. That's why the commentary always distorts reality. So if you just turn the sound down, do that next time you watch the TV, your favourite programme, turn the sound down, and then you find it just absolutely stupid, it's banal, and you wonder why you ever watch that sort of stuff. But it's a commentary which creates the interest sometimes. So that's why in the present moment awareness, you've still got a commentary going on, just like on the TV. But then you turn it down, so it's mute. So you're looking at life without a commentary. And then actually if you're watching a soccer match or you're watching a movie or watching anything, you get all the information you need. You can see for yourself. You don't need the commentary to tell you what's going on. And in fact, you probably can see it much clearer than a commentator. Which is why, stop the commentary inside, and that is silent present moment awareness. much closer to the truth. Next question. I really, really want an Ajahn Brahm t-shirt. Every time I see one, it brings up such strong, strong desire. That's understandable. You know, when I was in Indonesia once, there's a few Indonesian people here, and they had all these t-shirts for, you know, me going on this tour. And I had to sign them all. I was signing t-shirts. It really gets, you know, I don't know where this is going to end up, signing things. But anyway, so could you please make them available to buy at the end of the retreat, if not before? Have we got any left, Dania?
Large and extra large.
Large and extra large. So if you want one at the end of the retreat, please eat a lot. And then you can actually get one to fit. That's okay. So,
can you even get it now if you want? Not now.
Now, okay, yeah. Large and extra large. So, yeah, okay. Put on weight and then you can get one. Where do they actually come from? Who made
Malaysia.
Them? Malaysia. Okay. So, well, just take one home and just, you know, print it out and just make some more. Oh, now this is an interesting one. Dear Ajahn, this question is for you and the nuns as well. So you've got to do some work now. How do you feel being the ordained persons? Should we also take ordination? Being an ordained person, you feel free, at peace, oh, so happy. Now that's actually true, that when I first became a monk, was how long ago? 37 years ago. I had nightmares. This is true. I'd wake up in a sweat. In my nightmare, this is no exaggeration, this is how much I really, really wanted to be a monk. My nightmare was I was a layperson. I thought I wasn't a monk after all. And I'd open my eyes and I'd see my robes next to the bed. I'm a monk. I really am a monk. And I'd just go to sleep, this very peaceful, deep sleep. And that was about for a week. And that's how much I really love being a monk, and I never look back. So that was my nightmare. I was terrified that I wasn't a monk. And so happy that I was a monk. So it's a great thing to be. So that's how I feel being an ordained person. I don't know why many of you don't do it. Actually, that is a problem now, because we've got too many people wanting to become monks. So, you know, even just this evening, there was, you know, one Sri Lankan person, monk, wanted to come and visit for the rains. Had to tell the secretary, so we've got no space. And there's another young man wanted to become a monk. Can't do it. There's not too many people on the waiting list. So should you also take ordination? Yeah, take ordination, but please build some more huts for the nuns and the monks, first of all. So we've got a place to stay. So it really is a great thing to do. I don't know, it may be because of the global financial crisis, that people are bankrupt and they're becoming monks to escape the tax man and everybody else. I don't know. But anyway, that's how I feel about being ordained. So, who amongst the bhikkhunis are going to answer the question? How do you feel? Okay. Bhikkhuni Satima. Oops. How do you feel about being...
I feel great.
There you go. No, come on. You've got to do it on the... Here we go. This is Bhikkhuni Satima here. How she feels being a bhikkhuni.
I feel great. I felt the same too when I became a bhikkhuni. That was, I think I was radiating with joy so much that I was at the airport and the flight attendant came up to me and says, "Venerable, you can board the plane first." So that was the first time that something like that happened too. So that was
one of the
privileges
you get.
Privileges, yes. So
I feel similarly. I can't say that, you know, it's all peace and joy all the time. I brought my defilements with me. But I just... this is absolutely how I want to live. And...
How long have you been a bhikkhuni now?
Since 2003. Something like that.
Very good.
But it's just a wonderful thing. I'm just incredibly, it goes beyond grateful. I'm astounded that I get to do this. I just want to add, whether anyone else should do it, it takes huge commitment. I think there's a phase in people's practice, as lay people, that they have kind of this idea, maybe they'd like to ordain. I think it's a beautiful phase, but it takes huge commitment.
Just like a marriage, but it's much more fun than being married.
Precisely.
I can't imagine doing anything else or being anything else. So just a tremendous sense of gratitude to the Buddha and to everybody else who helped to bring these ordinations about. So it's not only just the bhikkhuni ordination. First you ordain as a samaneri, as an anagarika, then as a samaneri, and then as a bhikkhuni. So for me it's the culmination of many aspirations, and I wish everybody else would be able to do it, and I can't think of anything else what I would like to do right now. Thank you very much.
Are you going to ordain? I hope so. Are you going to ordain?
I would like to. I'd encourage it.
Very good. Very good. I knew that answer because he's coming to monastery. So it's very, very good.
And one of the great benefits of being a monk is because we don't have kids, we lessen the the population of the world. So it means that we're helping with stopping climate change. The biggest problem with climate change is too big population. So I really want sort of to have the laws in Australia and other countries that every other man, 50% of men have to become monks for life, and 50% of the girls have to become nuns, and that way the population will go down, no climate change, will save the world. What are you laughing at? That's actually serious. No, anyway. Could you please explain the benefits of silence, and should we also try to speak less after the retreat? Look, I know because I speak so much. You know, you speak so much, sooner or later you put your foot in the mouth and you say something you shouldn't. And this is one of the problems. So look, the more quiet you are, the less trouble you get into. Somebody once, this was actually a British playwright, John Updike, The Secret of a Happy Marriage. Secret of a Happy Marriage is when you are wrong, admit it. When you're right, shut up. If those of you have been married, you probably agree with that. Because a lot of times, you know, you speak and it just makes matters worse, so just be quiet. Now, one interesting thing about silence, this is a very good technique when, you know, you're out there in the world and people start getting angry at you and you shout at you. Especially it might be like a partner or a really close friend. So they shout at you, they get angry at you. When they finish, do the 15-second pause or the 10-second silence. Just be silent for a few minutes. Don't speak back straight away. Because usually what happens when someone is arguing at you and they finish, then you sort of go and defend yourself. Bah, 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 bah. But if you give the 10-second silence, that pause, you're not speaking. You're giving that person who's just got angry at you a chance to reflect on what they've just done. A lot of times, you know, in that silence, they actually see that they behave terribly. They've spoken really badly to you. If you don't give them that 10-second silence to reflect, they never see that. So it's a very skillful means. Someone is shouting, you're getting angry at you. When they finish, you're quiet for 10 seconds. Give them the chance to reflect. And then you can speak afterwards if you want. But usually in those 10 seconds, they realize what a stupid thing they've done. Silence can be very, very powerful. So, there's an old Buddhist saying as well. It is, the great rivers flow silently. It is the small streams which make all the noise. So what do you want to be? The big river or the little stream? you speak too much, your words are just like dirt, they're all over the place. If you only speak a little amount, because of the rarity of your words are like diamonds. They're a treasure. When I first came to Perth, I was number two monk. And that's why, just like these monks, they sit quietly. Their job is not to speak. The senior monk does all the talking. So Ajahn Jagwa would give all the talks, would answer all the questions. I was just his attendant. Then after about 9 months, he went to Thailand. So I was the head monk, so I had to speak. And as soon as I started speaking, this young girl, she was about 14, came up to me afterwards and said, "That's amazing. You can speak." "I thought you were brain damaged." She said that. She burst out laughing. Because I was quiet and silent, she wasn't used to a person sitting quietly. And it wasn't brain damage, it was just restraint. And peace is nice being quiet. So there's huge amounts of benefits in silence. So when you go out, back into the world, don't speak so much. Restrain. And number one, you don't get into so much trouble. Number two, when you do speak, people pay more attention to you. And number three, you give other people a chance just to reflect on what they're doing. Then I know at the end of this retreat, just usually at lunchtime on Sunday, I give people free permission to talk. You don't have to keep the noble silence anymore. You know what happens? People, no, I don't want to talk. It's much more fun being silent. That's why I do that little trick. You can if you want to, but actually I don't want to. So you start to appreciate how wonderful it is being silent. And you can be friends to a person. You can smile at them. You have this beautiful sense of good friends meditating together, like a group which cares for each other without having to speak. So you realize you can still love someone and care for them without words. And sometimes that's even more powerful than just sometimes words which are empty and you can't really believe. Silence is brilliant. Ajahn, why is it that sometimes one gets a feeling of not wanting to meditate at all? It goes on for days. What should one do? Meditate anywhere, just let go and do something else, like read a book or listen to some Dhamma talks. Once you come back to the meditation, then it takes a while, even months, before deep samadhi sets in. Why? Thank you. Like sometimes, it's because you've had given your mind a hard time before. That's why you don't want to meditate. You've been bruised. Why is it that, there was this guy, he was taking me to a retreat, to teach a retreat, and he was in this retreat centre in Sydney. And as he was driving, I was going to teach the retreat, he kept on saying, "I don't really want to come to this retreat, but I'm a board member of this place, I have to come." And then said, what's wrong with the place? He said, you have to sit for hours and it's really painful and get really bored out of my skull. And he said, he called the meditation hall, he gave it the nickname, the torture chamber. And so every time he came to meditate, he was going into the torture chamber. And it's because that sometimes he didn't have any happiness or joy in meditation. It was just too painful. Some of these meditations where you have to sit down and everybody has to come, and at 45 minutes, 50 minutes, they bing the gong and everyone has to walk, and then ding the gong, and then you sort of have to go and walk again. And some of those meditations, what it does to you is the mind doesn't want to meditate anymore. It's like going to the torture chamber, like going to the dentist. You only go if you really have to. So you can see just why the mind doesn't like meditating if you force it like that, and the mind associates meditation with going to the torture chamber. So I told this guy, right, for this retreat, look at the meditation hall as the entertainment center, not the torture center. And I give lots of jokes and give lots of happiness. And when you look at meditation as being something happy, it's something you want to do, not something you have to do. So the trick is motivating yourself through joyful, happy, peaceful meditation to want to meditate. Now again, I know this from personal experience, because early on when I was still a layperson, first couple of years I'd meditate every morning almost without fail. But as a layperson, you start to get busy, you miss a couple of morning meditations, and then after a while I wasn't meditating much at all. And then I remember having a cup of coffee somewhere, and I think I was visiting India or something, I'm not quite sure, but, and there was this German guy, and we were just, you know, chatting in a coffee shop, and he was, you know, I said, oh, yeah, I used to meditate, and he said, why didn't you carry on meditating? Oh, I don't know, I'm not really getting anywhere, it's a bit boring. And he gave me this piece of advice, which, you know, really sort of changed me, and got me going again to really enjoy the meditation. He said, at the end of every meditation, you should pause and ask yourself how you feel. He said, you'll find that even those things you think as bad meditations, you've made a lot of progress. You feel so much more peaceful and happy after every meditation. And that was a brilliant piece of advice, because the reason I wasn't meditating, because I didn't think it was working, wasn't getting anywhere, it was a waste of time. Well, the reason was because I meditated and then as soon as I finished, I'd get up and do something else. I wouldn't pause to see what had happened. And so now, you know, those of you who listen to me at Northern Mara, I always do that. At the end of every guided meditation, I say, no, soon we're going to come out of meditation. Now, how do you feel? What effect has that meditation had on your mind and your body as well? How much peace, how much sense of freedom and happiness do you have? And I do that because I know after every meditation, even those meditations you think haven't worked so well, still you're more peaceful, you feel more free, you feel more sort of sense of contentment than when you started. It has worked. And so if you reflect on that after every meditation, you realize the value of meditation. You experience it's working. And because of that, you like meditating. You want to meditate. You see the benefit of meditating. And that means that you don't have to, I don't feel like meditating. You want to meditate. As the Buddha said, you know, as soon as you want to meditate, it's like, you know, you go to take the dog for a walk. As soon as you get up and, you know, get hold of the lead, the dog starts to wag its tail. It realizes it's going for a walk. You don't have to force the dog to go for a walk. It loves going for a walk. It has so much fun going for a walk. And that's what my mind is like. As soon as you start meditating, way, he's taking me for meditation today. Ooh, yes. So you really like doing it. So when you get the joy and see the benefit of meditation, you really see the benefit. Of course, then you want to do it, and it's easy to do. If you don't see the benefit, you don't see the joy, of course, you know, you just let it go. And it will just disappear. So especially when the meditation gets really joyful, and you get, you know, you really feel this is wonderful, of course you love doing it. It's better than watching the TV. Just watching your mind, being peaceful, being happy. What more can you want in life? Ajahn Brahm, can you please elaborate on how to stay in the present moment? Why, when you get present moment awareness, do you wander off? And it's again because you're not enjoying yourself. It's not fun being in the present moment, because some other moment appears better. The fantasy, the plan, the old memories. You think that's more enjoyable than the present moment. But if you're really enjoying this moment, having great fun, you don't wander off. Which is why when you get into the present moment, at first, be kind to it. There, present moment. No, I'm sorry I keep sort of, you know, avoiding you, but you're really nice. Look, it's an old trick. I smile at you, and you smile back, don't you? It's hard not to. So you smile at the present moment, and the present moment smiles back. It actually looks more beautiful. It's easier to watch. That's why in this moment, just see if you can smile at it, be kind to it. And then this present moment is wonderful to be with. You're developing the joy in this present moment. However, because, you know, you stay in the present moment so often, sometimes you get bored. You know, I've got to watch the breath again, watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. How long do I have to do this? This sucks. So what you do, like I said earlier, put some fun into the meditation. Still, I mean, none of you have tried, you know, meditating backwards. You're always facing this direction. Come on, guys. You know, turn around, do it a different way. And has anyone done the kangaroo walking meditation yet? Has anyone done it? Oh, come on, give it a try. So look, because I was doing a lot of breath meditation, and sometimes we need to sort of be a bit inventive. So I developed another form of breath meditation called the backwards breath meditation. It makes it more interesting. I will now demonstrate the backwards breath meditation for you, because I need your help here. So you don't need to change your posture. When I say go, I want you to close your eyes, breathe in and out three times. Count the breath, and at the end of the third breath, open your eyes. Is that clear? Don't change your posture as you are. Already? Go. Just breathe in and out three times as mindfully as you can. Then open your eyes. Very good. Now, I guarantee that when you were watching those three breaths, you started with the in-breath. In, out, in, out, in, out. Because that's our conditioning. Now I want you to do the same exercise. When I say go, just close your eyes and watch three breaths. But now start with the out-breath. Out first and then in. Out, in, out, in. And at the end of the third in-breath, open your eyes. Okay? Go. And you will notice that that was totally different. A totally different experience. It should be the same, but it is different. And that is what we call the backwards breath meditation. You breathe out first and then in. Out, in. Out, in. Out, in. And you'll find it's different. It's just playing around. But it makes it much more fun. So if you get very bored and you can't be mindful watching your breath, try reversing the order. Out first and then in. It actually is different and fun. And if that doesn't work, the other variation of the breath meditation of Anapanasati is the three in-breaths to the one out-breath. Give it a try. It actually works. Instead of being bored out of your skull, breathing in, breathing out, have fun with it. Or, with the breathing, you can actually start to get a little mantra going with the breath. Breathing in peace. Breathing out pain. Because, sometimes you hurt. Or, breathing in breathing in love. Breathing out stress. Let all the stress go out. And breathing in love. And if you do that with the breath, it makes it interesting. And after a while, actually you do feel like love or metta coming in and all the stress and all the negative going out. It makes it interesting. And you can actually just make your own little words up. You don't have to follow what I do. I think somebody was, that's why there's one person, they had a great mantra. They said, breathing in peace, breathing out, letting go. Breathing in peace. Breathing out, letting go. And a wonderful time, because it makes it interesting. Therefore, you can stay in the present moment. You don't get bored. You don't wander off. You don't go to sleep. You're innovating and making this meditation sort of many, many different things you can do to give it that interest. And it all just moves to the same place in the end. So that's why I often give lots and lots of different techniques. So you can use this one and that one all over the place, backwards breath meditation, the kangaroo walking meditation, whatever, just to give yourself interest. And then it's very wonderful to stay in the present moment. Is there a way to integrate Reiki practice with meditation? Are these two separate practices? No. What you can do, we've got lots of rakes outside. So just rake mindfully. Get the leaves and all the weeds. That's called Reiki meditation. We've got weedy meditation. That's when you very mindfully take out the weeds and the grass. Now you can do the best. Reiki, as long as you are at least being in the present moment, being silent, and getting lots and lots of metta, then it can work.
Is forgiveness something you can ever have, or is only something you can be willing to practice and offer yourself and others in the moment? As the pain, hurt resurfaces, it felt like it's something you need to keep doing. It's never done. Of course it's finished with, it's done. Because after a while, you realize that you're just hurting yourself again and again and again and again. And it's absolutely ridiculous. It's stupid. Okay, this is one of my favorite stories about the stupidity why people can't forgive. I know that some of you have heard this so many times, but it is a great story. It is the two chicken farmer story. And when I first said this psychology conference, the therapists, they love this, and they use it. They told me they use it in their sort of work all the time. So the two chicken farmer simile goes like this. Once there were two chicken farmers, and the first chicken farmer got up early in the morning to collect the produce of the night before. So they got the basket, a bit bigger than this, went into the chicken shed, and they filled the basket full of chicken shit. And they left the eggs in the shed. They brought the shit back into the house, where it made a big stink, and the family were very upset. That was a very stupid chicken farmer. The chicken farmer number two took the basket into the shed to collect the produce of the night before. He filled the basket full of eggs. He was a smart chicken farmer. He left the shit in the shed to rot, where it would become valuable fertilizer later. But he only brought the eggs into the house, so he could make a nice omelette for his family and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That was a smart chicken farmer. And the meaning of that story is, whoever wrote this question, what type of chicken farmer are you? Are you a shit collector or an egg collector? When you remember your past, what do you put in your basket and bring home with you? The shit. What they did to me, all the rotten things which have happened to me, all the terrible bad luck I've had in my life, and that's all you collect. That's why you get angry and depressed. Forgiveness means letting the shit rot in the past and only collect the eggs. The wonderful things which have happened to you over your life, the great happy moments you've had, those are the things you should collect. Then you're a smart chicken farmer. Unfortunately, in our life, most people only collect the shit. That's why marriages break up, isn't it? What you did last year, what you did 10 years ago, what are you collecting that for? That should have rotted a long time ago. Collect all the beautiful memories, all the happy times, all the happy moments you've had in your life. If you could do that and become an egg collector, you're a much happier person. And all the pain of the past doesn't affect you. It's rotted a long time ago, where it should have. So please be an egg collector, not a shit collector. I have a health condition which may be caused by stress. Do you have any tips? Yeah, get a new body. No, look, if it's caused by stress, meditating is letting go, being kind, being gentle, rest a lot. Eat nice food, go for walks. Ask your body, body, what do you need? If you ask the body will tell you. A lot of times you never ask. And that's why you get stressed. The body wants something, you never give it to it. So that's why the body gets very tired, very fed up with you, and gets stressed out and gets sick. And after a while it says, I don't like you anymore, and dies. That's what happens. So, just be kind to the body, be sensitive to the body, and your body gets very, very healthy. But there was this great story of, in one of the retreats I gave over, again, before we got this place, in the Redemptorist Monastery. Now, Bianca, she brought this guy to me at the beginning of the retreat, because he was a mess. He had this eczema, this rash, all over his body. I think he had to wear this rubber mask, actually, to stop him scratching himself.
It looked disgusting. And I was really sort of concerned about this fellow because, you know when you've got an itch. This was really bad eczema. And, you know, even in Guantanamo Bay, they only torture you for a number of hours in the day, then they send you back into your cell. But this guy, 24 hours, just this incredible itch and just would never go away. And, you know, I had this incredible compassion for this guy. I don't know how he can stand it. You know, I just, every time I've had an itch, you know, just scratching it for a few minutes, and this is constant. So he came and said, look, nothing has worked. He's going to try meditation as a last resort. But he said, look, I don't know if I can even last a day. You know, that's why I've come to see you. Just, if I leave, it's nothing about you. It's just, I just can't stand this. But he lasted the 9 days. The whole 9 days he lasted. And when the last day he came to see me again, and he showed me his body. And he had this tiny little rash just around his ankles. And he said, this is a miracle. I can't thank you enough. This is nothing now. Just a slight little itch around my ankles. The rest of my body is totally free. You can see now the rash had totally gone from his face. And everybody knows that eczema is a stress-related condition. And he learned how to let go and relax and make peace. And it was not just that he felt peace. You could actually see it on his body. It was just written on his body with all this healthy skin with no pustules on it. And that made me feel so happy that, you know, he'd actually done something to take away a huge amount of physical suffering from this fellow. And it was just a wonderful experience seeing that. And I was just so overjoyed that he wasn't, you know, suffering was just 99.9% all relieved. It was really gross suffering as well. So it does work, but don't be one of those people that say, I've got to sit, I've got to watch the breath to get rid of my stress. That's more stress. So just, you know, relax. This is one of the toughest things for a teacher to do, is to ask a person to relax. Because some of you come here and I'm meditating. I'm going to get up early. I don't want to sleep so much. You know, I'm going to make the best out of this retreat. I'm going to get jhana on this retreat. I'm going to go through pain. I'm not going to eat something. I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to be tough. I'm going to be... Oh, come on, relax a bit. Be kind to yourself. You deserve it. Don't be so cruel to yourselves. So even if you're hurting in meditation, move, for goodness sake. You know, if your nose itches, scratch it. Pick your nose. I don't care. I'm not going to get upset at you. All these conventions which we have in this world, we're not supposed to do this, we're not supposed to do that, just gets you more sort of stress. Oh, come on. Just relax. Be more peaceful. And then, you know, even when you're meditating, lean against the wall. Get on the chairs. Have a nice, comfortable body. If you do that, you relax a lot and you get peaceful, and many of the health conditions just heal themselves. And it's very rare you can come to a place and you're not asked to achieve anything. There are no goals to meet. And no one is going to criticize you. All of you who've been to the interviews, and have you noticed, I always do this, I always say very good. And some of you said, no, I haven't been meditating, I've been all over the place, and I've said, very good. And then I told you why I do that, is because I want you to feel free, just to be happy to be who you are. Because if I said, oh, that's not very good, then here we go, we're back at school again, back where we have to live up to someone else's expectations, back having to achieve, having to meet this goal and that goal, that's the cause of stress. So just like, let go and just be. Not only do you let go of stress, but you get the most deepest of meditations. There was, she's not here this retreat, she comes often on retreats. She was on a retreat which I was giving in, it was a Khao Lak retreat, the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, but she was a Malaysian girl. 9 days, 9 days she'd been meditating, getting nowhere. Really frustrated. And at the end of the just before lunchtime, we finished before lunch because people had to get on these buses to go back to the airport and catch a plane back here and there all over the place. But she was going on a late bus, so she had about 45 minutes before lunch. So she told me, nothing to do, so she was just meditating, killing time. And then she came up to me, and I was having my lunch because I had to have it early before 12 o'clock.
And she sat down and looked up at me with his big eyes. I said, Bob, at last, I've done it. Oh, so nice. She got her first deep meditation. And then I asked her, so what did you do this time? And actually, I was doing nothing. I was killing time. Exactly. All this time you've been trying to achieve this and trying to get that. And now at once you've actually just let go. You know, doing nothing, just killing time. Yes, well done. And then she learned what it was to let go. And how easy it is when you actually press that letting go button. And how difficult it is to find that button and let go. If you do, then all the health problems, they just almost vanish. That's what we do. And I don't care if it's like the whole 9 days of wasting time. If you just press that letting go button once and realize what I'm talking about. Could you please tell us a story about the superpowers of some of the ancient forest Thai monks? Okay. There was one of these monks, and he was living in the jungle. And living in the jungle, meditating, in those days, you know, people would be able to feed you, no problem at all. And he had like perfect solitude, meditating day and night. Really good monk. And of course, it just happens after a time you get these deep meditations, and after deep meditations, sometimes you get these powers. And actually, you know, he could fly through the air. And you know, he would just, you know, every morning, just have a flight, like almost like exercise. But the trouble was that somebody saw him. This is why if any of you do get psychic powers, please don't do them in public. Because you always get into big trouble every time. So, somebody saw him, and of course the word gets around. And when the word gets around, you know, for example, you know, it's not the case if you heard that someone at Dhammasara Nansi Monastery could fly through the air. You'd all go down there and have a look. And then you'd be hassling the nuns. Come on, just show us. Come on, come on. But anyway, this monk, as soon the word got to the king, and the king said, I always wanted to see, you know, a real monk levitating. Would you like to see a monk levitate? Would you? Of course you would, yes. So the king would. No, we're not going to do it, so forget about it. But this king, you know, if you're a king, you've got power. So he sent his army up there, you know, and said, you know, the king summons you. He said, I don't want to go to the palace. I'm just a simple monk. He said, no, this is not a request. You're coming. So, you know, he brought him to the palace. And the king was, you know, a really good sort of Buddhist. He actually built a little kuti, a hut for this monk, you know, and there's some forest in the grounds. He said, monk, just, you know, you can stay here. Not you can, you will stay here. And I would just want to, you know, I want to feed you, you know, make merits, make good karma, because you're obviously a holy monk, and to ask questions, you know, about Dhamma, and also get some advice on, you know, running my kingdom, because you're obviously wise, and you're not in it for the money like all my ministers and politicians, you know, you're just wise. So, now I'll feed you, live here, you can meditate and fly through the air as much as you like, and I want you to be my, like, wise advisor, which made a lot of sense. So the monk assented, and you know, the king would feed him really nice food, and he'd be, you know, in this little forest in the palace grounds, just like being in the jungle, and every morning he'd go for his exercise through the air. But one day, as he was coming into land, that morning the person who was bringing him food was one of the princesses, because the king couldn't come himself, and she was drop dead gorgeous, a hot chick. And this monk, as he was coming into land, he just saw her. Just one moment. That's all it took. One moment of lust. And he lost his ability to fly. And had to do crash landing. And when he realized, he couldn't fly after that. So he walked back. That after lunch, he walked right back to the plane. Didn't care about the king at all. And it took him 2 or 3 years to get his flying powers back again. That was how sensitive these psychic powers are.
So yes, there are psychic powers, but just one bit of anger, one bit of lust, one bit of pride, they all vanish and disappear. That's how sensitive they are. So you guys, you know, because you're, you know, not the bhikkhunis, but you're not monks, you know, you haven't overcome anger and lust, so please don't go flying through the air. You'll get high up there and something will come up, somebody will make a noise, it's that person again, and you'll come crashing down to the ground again and hurt yourself. That's why we don't do these psychic powers. But that was the psychic power a long time ago. Is that what you wanted to hear? Okay. What is mind? When everything else disappears, then it's the mind. That's why we, you know, the insight into the nature of the mind. There's a simile I give of the emperor. Once there was an emperor, very, very powerful, really important, but no one knew what the emperor was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, had his five garments covering his body, had his big boots which went up to his thighs, had his trousers which covered the top of his boots and came up to his waist, had a jacket on which covered the top of his trousers, came down to his wrists and up to his neck. He had these gloves which overlapped the sleeves of his jacket, and had this helmet which covered his whole head and overlapped the top of his jacket. So all those five pieces of clothing, the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves, the helmet, overlapped. So you couldn't see any part of the emperor's body. So no one knew if that emperor was a boy or a girl or gay. Don't know whether it was African, Chinese, Caucasian, or Eskimo, or whatever. And they didn't know whether he was old or young, or what he was, because they never saw him. They just knew he was incredibly powerful. So the only way they could find out what this emperor was one day take all the clothes off and see what was underneath. And that's the simile for your mind. Your mind is incredibly powerful. It's your emperor. But you don't know what it is, whether it's a girl or a boy or gay, whether it's African, Chinese, American, whatever. What is it? Vietnamese? So you have to take the five clothes off. Sight, hearing, smell, taste, and physical touch. Those five senses cover up our mind. So much so that we don't really know what it is. So when those five senses disappear, then you see the mind. And that is the job of meditation. A lot of times people think, yeah, they understand the mind. You don't. The first time it comes up is when it's this beautiful light in the mind. That's the start, this understanding what this mind truly is. In the deep meditations, when the five senses vanish, the only thing left is the sixth sense, the mind. It's right in front of you. Other senses are gone. Therefore you can understand what the mind truly is. Just like the Buddha's simile, if you really want to find out the properties of gold, the first thing you have to do is purify the gold so there's no other elements. There's just gold, gold, pure 100% gold. There's other elements, a bit of iron, a bit of tin, a bit of silver, then you can't understand what that element truly is. You have to make pure 100% gold, and then you can test it, and then you can find its properties. If you really want, this is the Buddha simile, if you really want to find out the nature of the mind, purify it of the five senses first of all. And then see what's a pure, unadulterated, just mind, nothing else. And then you can understand what it is. That's how you find out. When sustaining the breath, focus on this track due to lack of joy. Loving kindness seems to help. How do I combine these two? Have loving kindness on the breath. So your poor breath, going in and out all these years, ever since you were born, even when you're sleeping, it goes in and goes out. Ah, poor nice little breath. You've been so kind to me. I love you, breath. I know I've ignored you many, many times. So you look upon your breath like your pet rabbit. So you start stroking your breath, and the breath responds, oh, she loves me. The first time I did a loving kindness on the breath, Just now use the breath as my object of love. May all breaths be happy and well. I really respect you. The door of my heart's open to your breath, whichever way you want to come in. And oh, it's just amazing meditation, just so blissed out. And that was one of the nights when I dreamt of jhanas. That's one of the great dreams. You're dreaming there, just blissing out, and just sheer bliss in the middle of the dream. It's incredible. And in the morning, just straight back into deep meditation. Great time, because you manage to combine the meditation on loving kindness and the breath. It's very, very powerful. Just this softness and the kindness, because the breath became so joyful. It's easy to get into deep meditation. So try that, it's brilliant. A loving kindness, just feeling compassion and kindness to your own breath. Have a wonderful, wonderful time. Could you please elaborate right effort as part of the Noble Eightfold Path? How do you apply this in our meditation and daily life? Also, could you please tell us how to contemplate the body in meditation? Do we contemplate only when we're in a deep state of meditation, or we could use it as our object of meditation? Right effort is the effort to renounce, to let go, to stop, to cease, to abandon. That's what the effort is. The word effort, you know, one of the words is, or rather energy, is called virya. And as I mentioned to many people, that word is connected to the word for hero, viro. Now, viro is the Pali word for the hero. Virya is energy. So it's not just ordinary effort, it's like heroic effort. The effort, you know, that word in ancient India was the sort of effort the soldier would do, which is sacrifices his whole life in battle. Would not think for himself, would give up, or the mother who has sacrificed her life for a child. That's heroic effort. It's an effort which keeps nothing back for oneself. And that's the sort of effort we do in meditation. Not wanting things, but the effort to abandon and let go of everything. The ability, so even your most treasured possessions, to sacrifice them for the sake of truth and freedom and enlightenment. That's a heroic effort. The effort to let go of everything. So in the meditation, it's the effort to stop. The effort just to let go. The effort to be kind. The effort to be renounced. It's the effort to stop all efforts. It's the effort to press the let it go button so it turns off again. That's the effort. So it doesn't need to do anything more. The effort to be content, to be peaceful. So if you understand that, you understand what right effort is. And it's because we don't understand right effort, we do wrong effort. Always striving, always controlling, never letting go, wanting, attaining. That type of effort just builds up more sense of self. Bigger control freak. Remember, this is letting go of the ego, not making more ego. And most people, when they do willpower, they make bigger egos. You know, I have to check emails every now and again. There was an email this morning. It was from the Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils, and they always send me stuff. The Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils is the organisation, you know, which oversees, you know, Buddhism here in Australia. Many, many temples and groups belong, we belong. And they were saying, they got an email for this, I think, Sam Smith. He said, I would like to let you know, I'm now emancipated. I'm fully enlightened. So if you want to ask all of your questions, here is my email. And the email was the amazing Sam Smith. This is email now. There are lots of absolutely crazy people like that around. And they think of enlightenment as attainment. And just, you know, send email around to all the Buddhist groups so we can ask questions of him now and get the right answers for a change. But that is wrong effort. It just gives you a bigger ego. If anyone does get enlightened, you never announce it to anybody else. That's absolutely crazy. So that's why, you know, if you ask a nun, are you enlightened? They say, yes. That means no. So
So that's another question, because you just disappear. There's no one there to be enlightened. So that's actually one of the great sayings. I mentioned half of it. The path, I think I mentioned it, this is that the first night, from the Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. As long as there's a traveller doing effort, there's no path. When you let go, you disappear, there's no traveller. Then the path is so easy to get into meditation, to get enlightened. You have to disappear. You are the problem, your sense of self. The traveller, the doer, is the problem. And the second part of the poem is, Nibbana is, but not the person who enters. This idea of a me has to disappear. And then enlightenment is there for you. So enlightenment is, but you can't enter it. You have to let go totally of all your sense of identity. And then enlightenment happens. That's why what right effort is. And how to contemplate the body in meditation. You contemplate the body just enough to see it doesn't belong to you, so you can let it go, so it can disappear. That's the purpose of body contemplation, to be able to let it go so you can see the mind. So if you're really still attached to your old body or somebody else's body, you find it will never disappear. You can get so close, the breath is about to disappear. Ah, I'm not breathing, I'm going to die. If that's you, then you have to contemplate the body. Look, you're going to die anyway. I will die, that's for sure. You've died many times. So what's the big point? Another body, another life, another death. Here we go again. Come on. Let this body go. It doesn't belong to you. It's only a little vehicle. It's none of your business. So sit it down. Let it go. Away with your body. I don't care. Health, sickness, who knows. I just leave it alone. Let it disappear. And when it's done, it's disappearing, actually. You've only got the mind left. Then you know you've done enough body contemplation. You have to know its purpose. It's not just to see it's impermanent, not self-suffering. It's to do it. Not just some idea, some great insight. The way you know it's insight is if you can let it go. If you can allow it to disappear. Then you've understood the body. So once it goes, you've done all the body contemplation you need. What is the Buddhist view on recent man-created events in this world? That's sexist. It's women-created events as well. Margaret Thatcher is one of them. Such as Iraq, Afghanistan, ending of Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, or Lilki in the Gulf. The Buddhist view on recent created events in this world is here we go again. This is like samsara. It's always, I only studied history before. There's always been wars. So sometimes we think, no, we're going to create peace on this earth. You idiots. The only way is actually to get out of here. It's the nature of this earth, of human life, to have lots of suffering. We do have wars. We have times of peace, and then we have wars again. It's the nature of human beings. I've seen even the kangaroos. When they're sort of young, they always fight. If you just go over the road, and there's lots of kangaroos over there. One male, about five or six females over there. And those kangaroos and males have to fight to the death to get the females. Because that's what lust and desire does. So you may think I'm cynical, but I think I'm a realist. So your job, it's just to get out of samsara and take as many people as you can with you. Are there some traditions in Thailand training monks in tough ways? Are tough trainings help enlightenment easy? No, they don't. Look, if toughness worked, I would be tough. I am a tough monk. Maybe you think I need, mess around. But I went through all those years of just, for a Westerner to actually survive northeast Thailand, most Bangkok monks couldn't stand it, and they just ran away. This was a Westerner's, the sleeping on the hard floor with the tarantula spiders falling all over you, treading on snakes, and just eating food which was absolutely disgusting. Some of the things which I ate, I just frog soup once. with our rice. Now, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. You couldn't be a vegetarian because there was no vegetables. And I mean that. No vegetables, hardly any fruit. Well, I one meal of the day, a bowl of sticky rice. We had some sticky rice today, but that was good stuff, you know, the coarse stuff, with frog soup. Frog soup was this big pot with, you know, maybe 20 or 30 little frogs sort of in it. No salt, no garlic, just boiled frogs, as if they just jumped into the boiling water and there they were. So not only was it disgusting to look at, it was disgusting to taste. You know those little Chinese spoons which the monks use? They were just big enough, one frog on the spoon. So you had some rice and put the little frog on the spoon and put it in your mouth and crunched and swallowed. It was disgusting. I remember as a kid, there was a precursor to Monty Python's Flying Circus. For those of you who are aficionados of that, called, I think, I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. And they had a skit, like this radio program, which, you know, I used to listen to. And the skit was like in a movie theater, instead of selling ice cream or popcorn, they were selling Crunchy Frog. Crunchy Frog, Crunchy Frog, get your Crunchy Frog. And so people bought this Crunchy Frog. And you think the bones are still in it? Yes, that's why it's crunchy. And that was disgusting, and the whole humour was just how disgusting that was. And, you know, I laughed at that, and a few years later I was actually eating Crunchy Frog. So you did. You put it in your mouth and just crunched everything. It was disgusting. So, you know, that's what you have to do. So I'm a tough monk, but I saw so many good monks leave because, you know, the stomach problems, it was just too sick, too much pain. And I realized, you know, looking back on those years, many of those monks were probably being wonderful teachers now, great meditators, but it was far too tough for them. And that's why they couldn't make it. I was blessed with good health, and I was strong. I had good meditation. That's how I survived. But other monks, they couldn't do that. And that's why these days, I've been through, I know what it's like, and I'll never do that to anybody else. That's not the way of Buddhism. Middle way. Even these days, like, you know, seeing people just sit for so long, you know, in pain, thinking that once the pain is there, I'm going to learn something from it. You don't learn from it. You just get negative towards meditation retreats. You don't want to go anymore. So this is the Buddha's way. It's called the middle way. Avoiding the two extremes. The first is Atthagilamatthana Yoga, which means practices which literally tire and wear out your body. And that's like too much asceticism. I don't know what it is, but people think that the more pain, the more gain. And that's ridiculous. It does not work. If that was the case, all those people in the torture chambers of the world would be enlightened by now. They're not, and it's a terrible thing they have to go through. I don't know if you've ever, there's a group over here, it's called ASSETS in Perth, the Association of Survivors of Torture and Trauma, and I went there once to give a talk. What some of those people have been through, you know, I wouldn't like to tell you, they just make you, your skin creep. And what people have to endure in this world today, they're probably enjoying it right now, it's disgusting, it's sickening, and you think, how could one human being do that to another human being? So you don't get anywhere by being tough. You get by being wise. Not willpower, but wisdom power. That's the way to enlightenment. Wisdom power, not willpower. Be smart, don't be tough. And then you have wonderful meditation, get great insights, you become a wonderful person. So we know, you see, there's no jokes there because that's an important point of me. I've seen there, been there and just, it's wrong. What is the best way to handle samadhi in the head? The minute the eyes are closed, the sensations and energy build up in the head, the breathing is faint, and the body is not obvious. The body is not supposed to be obvious. The breathing gets faint. So samadhi in the head, I'm not quite sure what you mean. It may be that, you know, when you start to get peaceful, you get all sorts of energies in the head
The reason for that is you haven't let go of the body quick enough. This is one of the advantages when you do the breath meditation, you just know the feeling of the breath, you don't locate it anywhere on the body. It means you're letting go of the body earlier. So when samadhi just happens, when the mind becomes still, the breath disappears, you've got no body left. But if you've been focusing on the tip of the nose or on your belly, you're too much focused on the body doesn't vanish. And if you do get samadhi, you do get some energy, sometimes it just goes into the body, but it can be quite uncomfortable. Eventually you get things like kundalini, but that's very, very hard to handle. And it's really not the right way to practice. It was a great for me to be able to have that hay fever, so I had to develop awareness of the breath, not the tip of the nose, not the belly, but just noticing the breath. So when the breath got very faint and very, very subtle, the body had mostly disappeared. Soon it did disappear. And I was sweet, it was wonderful. And all the energy was in the mind, in that sixth sense. There was none in the body. So it built up these beautiful meditations, very blissful. So if you keep awareness of the body when the meditation gets very deep, it becomes a problem. You should have let the body go a long time ago. So please, don't focus on a part of the body when you're meditating, focus on the breath. And then the body vanishes and you have a great time. But one of the problems, I already mentioned the problem with the mosquitoes, and Ajahn Chah used to call it Ajahn Mosquito. We used to have so many mosquitoes on us. The first weeks at this Wat Nana Chat, Ajahn Chah would come, we'd all sit meditation for an hour and a half outside at 6 p.m. Now, this was at dusk when all the mosquitoes came out. I don't know how you could do that, because it really was torture. You had hundreds of mosquitoes on you and you had to sit perfectly still. And I opened my eyes, just couldn't stand anymore and want to run and see all these other Thai monks sitting perfectly still. I didn't know at the time they didn't bite the Thai monks, they bit the Westerners. And it wasn't just, as I was joking the other day, as no Western food. The reason was is the Westerners' metabolism was higher than the Thais. We exuded more carbon dioxide and that was the neon light for the mosquitoes. The more carbon dioxide comes out of your pores, the more the mosquitoes know you're there. So for a Caucasian, we were just like this neon light, come over here. They could see us much easier. And that's why we got all these mosquitoes. And I was playing this game, one way of dealing with the situation, with one of the other monks, an American monk called Damico, his name was. But anyway, so he was a novice at that time. And we were counting the mosquitoes on us. We get to about 60 or 70 at one time and you couldn't count anymore. They were literally too close together. You couldn't resolve them because they're too close. And the only way I survived was I really watched my breath until the body disappeared. And because I could watch my breath, if my attention went to the body, it was just intolerable. All these irritating mozzies. So I really watched the breath very carefully, very gently, until the body disappeared. So I could meditate there and I didn't feel the body, didn't feel any mosquitoes. And then what actually happened, when I would come out of meditation, there'd be none of these little bumps, these little welts which mosquitoes would usually leave on Westerners. And I thought it was some magic of meditation. You get deep meditation and all of the welts disappear. And I didn't realize it wasn't magic. It was actually just nature, chemistry, because I was getting so peaceful, so calm, metabolism went right down, which meant I wasn't exuding any carbon dioxide, or very little carbon dioxide from the pores. So I became invisible to the mosquitoes. There was a reason behind that. So the more you worry about mosquitoes, the more upset you get, the more your metabolism goes up, the more carbon dioxide comes, the more you get bitten. So by really relaxing and becoming so still in meditation, the mosquitoes didn't see me. That was why I'd come out afterwards and have no bites. And all the other monks would. And that's how I dealt with that. You had to really let go of the body. Otherwise, you'd have it's intolerable irritation from so many mosquitoes. That's why they were Ajahn Mosquito for me. They taught me how to meditate. Why do monks and nuns shave their heads? Because we can't afford combs. Can you please explain bowing and the benefits of chanting?
Yes, the reason why you bow is because it exercises the tummy muscles so you don't get so fat. And you chant to scare away the tigers. Have you ever seen any tigers in China Grove? You see, it works. Now, one of the reasons of bowing, just to be serious, is somebody asked me this because they have difficulty in bowing. And I said, look, when I bow, the first time I bow, I don't bow to a metal god or whatever. First time I bow to what it represents to me, virtue. Because virtue is really important to me. You know, sila, goodness, keeping precepts. That's caused me so much happiness in my life. I really worship my precepts. So I bow to virtue. The second time I bow to peace, stillness, and meditation. Because I really have so much happiness in my life from my meditation. So I really worship that. So the second time I bow down to meditation, to peace. And the third time I bow down to compassion. Because I love compassion. And again, it's something I can very easily worship. So the three times I bow down, virtue, peace, and compassion. And so I'm worshipping those things. I'm holding, by putting my head down, I'm holding these really high above me. And that means every time I bow, I'm remembering the importance of virtue, peace, and compassion. So those things grow in my life. So it's a reminder every time. So you don't just bow down to a metal image. You bow down to what it represents. To me, it's virtue, peace, and compassion. You can make up your own list of important qualities, what you want to bow down to. That's what I bow down to. I was telling someone earlier that I went to one of the top Christian schools here in Perth as Christchurch Grammar. The first time I was invited to go and teach the assembly, give like a spiritual talk. And so all the kids were inside and I was waiting outside with the principal and the chaplain, Frank Sheehan, a really good friend now. And the principal turned round to me and said, this is a Christian school. So we've got a little Christian shrine there. And when we go in, we bow. But you're a Buddhist, you don't have to bow. And being a cheeky monk, I said to the principal, I demand my right to bow to your shrine. And I explained, look, now I'm not a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, but I can see something in that shrine which I can bow to. You know, the kindness. So I can bow to that. And then he got really interested, and I go to that school regularly, and they come to our monastery. Because, you know, it's something in any person, you can always see something to respect, and that's what you remember. So you can bow to that. You may not be a perfect person, but there's something inside you which you can respect and love. Bow to that. And then that thing which you see in yourself will grow and grow and grow. So, by me bowing to virtue, peace and compassion, those qualities grow. Was the Buddha vegetarian? No, apparently not. Would eating slaughtered animals with all their suffering be a hindrance to meditation? I don't know, maybe if their sacrifice goes into the tummy of a holy monk, maybe they get extra merit and get a better rebirth. I'm only trying to make you laugh. Old joke. I am a vegetarian, not because I love animals, but because I hate plants. That's why I like killing plants. That's all right. I'm a vegetarian, not because I love animals, but because I hate plants. Well, if a vegetarian is someone who eats vegetables, then what's a humanitarian? Can you please explain reincarnation with related to the mind? I'll leave that until you die, then you'll see it for yourself. Do meditators get good rebirth always? No, not always, but they only get good rebirth when they die. What happens to the mind in near-death experiences? It just carries on. How does the Dalai Lama choose his successor, by meditation or by other means? I don't know, I think he's just tosses a coin. Now, these are serious questions. We're getting late now, so maybe I'll leave that for tomorrow. because enough questions and answers now, so it's getting late. So again, today we had lots of questions. Yesterday we finished them all off and some more, so I'm sure we'll be able to finish these off tomorrow. There was some important serious stuff this evening, some funny stories. So remember, the funny stories is just like the just sometimes the sugar you used to take with medicine, you know, the jam on the bread, the curry on the rice, you know, it just adds a little bit of sauce and flavour to the main meal, which was all those important little sayings about, you know, things like when you're meditating on the breath, you know, don't focus on the body, you know, find out what the mind is. Take off the clothes of the emperor, no five senses, you can see the mind what it truly is. Those sorts of things, which I said, are the really important part of what you've been listening to this evening. So please remember that. Don't just remember the jokes and the funny stories. And then you can have a wonderful meditation. So have a great night tonight. Again, don't be so stressed out that you get sick. Have good rest when you go to bed at night. Just give a bit of loving kindness to yourself. What I do when I go to bed at night, I always say, I got into this habit. I'm not a stupid monk. I keep on saying to myself, good night, Ajahn Brahm. Have a great night's sleep. And the first thing when I wake up in the morning, here I am again. Nice to see you again. Have a great day. So like, say good night to yourself and say good morning to yourself. Give yourself some loving kindness, some respect as you go to sleep at night, and some loving kindness and respect when you first wake up. It's a great way to start the day, by being kind and giving some metta to yourself. So have a great night. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.